Now, thank you very much for coming in and chatting, and also I want to congratulate you on the Brandeis University Creative Arts Award. I imagine that's a very exciting thing for you.
Well, I was very happy about that. I've had my predecessors are a very honorable list, and I was very glad to join them.
Who were some of the writers on that list?
William Carlos Williams, H.D., Hilda Doolittle, I think Wallace Stevens.
Some of the writers
whom I was reading when I was much younger and learning from.
You certainly are in good company, and it's a delight to have so distinguished a poet talk to me. I probably should do more poetry than I do do. One of the problems in interviewing poets is that often publishers don't make a point of promoting poets. Sometimes they make their books available to reviewers, but they rarely put a poet on the road.
You know, the fact is that we poets are very often on the road on our own. We do get asked to read. Poetry is by no means in such an invisible position as it's supposed to be in this country. I mean, I go about reading it not only university campuses but other places as well, and find very large, very enthusiastic audiences for poetry. And I don't mean just my own. I have taken part in various group readings here in New York City, on the West Coast, other places, which were packed and enthusiastically received. So this is something that we still seem to be wandering minstrels. It's something that a lot of us do a great deal of.
My goodness for that. Well, let's talk. I want to talk about you. I want to talk about your work, and I want to talk about your philosophy. One of the most interesting essays in your books was the one called Split at the Root, which described your life in Baltimore, growing up and your father and this sort of thing. Tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up in Baltimore and what you mean by split at the root.
Okay, well, that title refers back to a poem that I wrote in the 60s, in which I speak of myself as split at the root, neither Gentile nor Jew, Yankee nor rebel, which was a way of saying that I come from a mixed marriage of a Jew and a Gentile. I grew up in Baltimore, which is in many ways very southern still, but is not the South, and it's not the North. And I added that to that the line, I'm a good reader of histories. In other words, I need to find out who I am on both sides of the line. And I call the essay Split at the Root, alluding back to that, and no longer saying neither Gentile nor Jew, but recognizing that as half a Jew, I am a Jew, and needing to find out what that meant, having grown up in a very assimilated world, a very southern world, in some ways a very social Christian world, in which it was assumed that if one went to church, that one was a Christian. I would say not a world of enormous Christian passion, but just genteel Christianity.
But you were indeed baptized as an Episcopalian.
I was sent to the Episcopal Church by my parents, neither of whom would set foot in a church. And this was their way of providing the proper credentials for me and my sister to be in the world as part of the mainstream.
Those may be the proper credentials, so to speak, but I understand, I don't know too much about this, but I understand to actually be a Jew, your mother must be a Jew, and your mother was not. Is that correct?
That's correct. By the strictest Orthodox definition, your mother must be a Jew. However, in this period, this post-Holocaust period that we're still living through, a great many Jews are raising the question, who is a Jew? And a great many of us are claiming our Jewishness from and through our fathers. There are many of us, too, who, by strict Jewish definition, would not be accepted because we're gay. And we are trying to turn that around also. The whole question of Jewish identity at this point in history, and particularly in the United States of America, is very complex and very interesting, and I think very important.
But you are no longer split at the root in terms of your Jewishness.
I feel that that split will always be there for me because I was so raised in it, but it's certainly healing for me.
Do you now consider yourself Jewish?
I consider myself Jewish by identity, yes.
And not Christian?
Well, I never felt like a Christian,
a Protestant,
I have to tell you.
Say.
No, I never felt that I was part of that world. I was in it, but I never felt part of it.
I have a feeling from the way you have just described yourself now that you are still evolving and trying to come to grips with your identity. Is that accurate?
Well, I think that's a lifelong process. And where it's a question of, and why it's important, I mean, whether it's simply a kind of eternal self-scrutiny and navel-gazing, or whether it has any purpose in the world or any meaning or function outside one's own self, I think is a real question. For me, it is a political question. I position myself, have been trying to position myself in terms of who I actually am and what I actually belong to, and not as part of some universal abstraction which doesn't serve, to know where my lot is cast. As I said in the poem Sources, with whom do you believe your lot is cast? From where does your strength come? And that always in the name of acting with greater clarity, writing with greater clarity.
Well, you certainly do that. Growing up in Baltimore, you obviously came from an intellectual household. Your father was a professor at Johns Hopkins. What was life like for you? And obviously, well, tell me a little bit about how your roots developed as a writer during these days in Baltimore.
Well, they certainly were very rooted in those days. I got an enormous amount of encouragement as a child from both my parents to write. My mother had been a composer and a concert pianist. She stopped her career as a musician when she married and had children, but she continued to play and the piano and to teach her children music. And that was a very important thing to have in my early life, for a poet to have that training in music and that hearing music in one's life all the time.
Were you writing poems as a child?
Oh, yes, yes. From the time I could write them out, I wrote them out myself. Before that, I recited them and they were written down. I loved poetry. I was always attracted to it from the time it was first read to me.
I believe you write in one of your essays, I can't remember which one, that the major poetic influences were middle-class white males.
Well, they had to have been, because what else was there visible at that time? I mean, there were women poets. There was Amy Lowell, there was Edna St. Vincent Millay, there was, of course, Emily Dickinson, beginning to be published in her entirety, in her complexity.
Of course, the males you cited weren't bad either.
Well, yes, they were very good. But in terms of seeing oneself, this young girl, this young woman, seeing herself as a poet, what did that mean? It seemed to mean that one was forced to choose between all of the elements that were presumed to be a woman's life and poetry. And I wanted everything.
Yeah, it seems from the way you described your earlier life, you were destined to become rather conventional person. You went to Radcliffe, you got married, I think you moved to Brooklyn, you raised
Never moved
boys.
To Brooklyn, used to spend lots of time there.
Your visiting. Husband was from Brooklyn.
Yes, and visiting his family, yes.
But that seems like a very conventional beginning for you, is that correct?
Well, it was conventional, it was intended to be conventional, however, our house was not, and I knew this in the way that children know these things, our house was different from other houses, and I didn't exactly know why. My father, for instance, was tremendously interested in the arts and read all kinds of books. He wasn't only a scientist, he loved the arts. He played the violin and the viola. Most of the fathers of my friends felt that culture was for women. It was fine, but it was for women. We were really outside of the world of the church and the country club and all of that, in which in that milieu, people rotated socially. My parents had chamber music groups that would meet at the houses of the members. My father belonged to a group with H.L. Mencken in downtown Baltimore, and which was all male, and then there was a mixed group that met at people's houses. And they played chamber music and orchestral music. And that was something that didn't happen in most people's houses in that milieu. So it was a somewhat different microcosm. But yes, we were being raised to be proper young women.
Which, of course, was proper in the 1940s,
Baltimore,
1950s,
yeah.
and Baltimore, because to a great degree, most of us, I guess, are constrained by the social bounds around us, tradition, custom, and so. But you broke loose somehow. Something changed. You were married for 17 years. I mm-hmm. presume that the marriage ended in divorce. You did raise three sons. What about this 17-year period? Were you working conventionally and raising a family in a conventional way? Were you beginning to break from this?
Well, it was a constant tension between the two because I had been writing poetry for so many years. And my first book came out when I was a senior at Radcliffe. And that was a kind of shock to me. I hadn't really expected to have a book at that age. But it did confirm something, too, that W.H. Auden had chosen these poems for the Yale Younger Poets series. At the same time, I wanted very, very much to fulfill what I had been taught and what I really believed was the woman's complete existence. I wanted to be married. I wanted to have children. And I was trying very hard to be a proper faculty wife in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and at the same time write poetry and live that kind of other life that made writing poems possible. So I think of that as a time of enormous tensions, dynamics between these two lives that didn't ever seem to fit.
How did it come about that you made this dramatic change where you embraced feminism, particularly during an important period in feminist culture, declared yourself a lesbian publicly? It must have been a very difficult thing to do.
Well, it wasn't as dramatic as it may seem. It's nothing, it seems to me, of that kind is a sudden turning of a corner and light flashing. I had been looking for feminism long before the women's movement reemerged. I'd been reading Mary Wollstonecraft, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman and Thoughts on the Education of Daughters, way back. I realize now I'd been searching for politics, and there were two things that I felt were inexplicable and totally confusing and very emotionally disturbing to me. And one was racism, and the other was what we later have come to call sexism. I grew up with heavy racism and an almost completely segregated society. And when the civil rights movement emerged in the early 60s, that was a tremendous release and relief to me, because suddenly there were words for all this and there was an understanding and analysis. I realized that the kinds of confusion and anguish and anger and humiliation and embarrassment that I had seen acted out between black and white people as I was growing up, that there was a social context for all that. It wasn't just these individuals or this family. And that was an enormous relief. And then bringing some kind of comprehension of the dynamics of domination and discrimination into other realms out of that.
Yeah, the feminist movement. But the civil rights movement almost merged into the feminist movement, didn't it?
Well, as did those other movements on the left, where women began having believed that these were movements for, quote, human liberation. Women were beginning to ask, but what about us? And not after the revolution, quote, but now. And in so many cases, from being parts of women's caucuses, broke off and formed the autonomous women's movement.
There are those who say the feminist movement as such is moribund today. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, Don, I had a wonderful experience last fall. I saw that New York Times article on the American Wife, I think it was called, and it's about the achieving post-feminist, quote, woman who has become an attorney or an executive, a broker, and finds that she's still unhappy and conflicted and so forth and so on. And at the end of this article it said, at a time when the women's movement is virtually invisible, and I took that into my feminist theory seminar at Stanford, and I brought along with it an armful of feminist periodicals, just the print media, from all around the country and all around the world. And here was this physical embodiment of a grassroots women's movement visible all around the world. And I said to my students, who says this is invisible? Why is it being described as invisible? In whose interest is it that it should be invisible? And I think that's my response to your question.
Well, I think what happens, and I could be wrong, I think what happens that when an issue is reported long enough, people get tired of it. In terms of news, I'm not talking about the feminists themselves, the people directly involved. It's like covering Vietnam. I remember when we covered Vietnam at CBS, you couldn't make a mistake. You could never be criticized by leading a newscast with a Vietnam story, even though it was the same story you had the day before. Guerrilla targets were bombed by U.S. warplanes over the border in Cambodia. It was the same story day after day after day. And after a while, you couldn't hear it. You couldn't see it. It was just there.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, there was much interest, and, of course, it led to the downfall of the president and the changing of our foreign policy. But is that also perhaps the case with the feminist movement? It's still perhaps, as you indicate, viable, similar, but you don't hear as much about it.
Well, I suppose I think that the media, CBS and, what we mean when we say the media in America, could be reporting on the women's movement in ways which would be of intense interest to people continually, because these are issues which affect all of us, which affect all of our lives. I think reporting on a handful of women and what they do does go stale. That's true. And, I myself am very bored with stories like, why is it that the yuppie woman is depressed? She has it all. She's post-feminist. Why is she depressed? There is so much more happening around the world, both in terms of women's resistance. I think about the leadership of black women in Soweto, for example, the extraordinary things that they are doing. Now, you know, South African news is also reported only in one way in the media.
It's very difficult to report.
I know that it now is very difficult to report from South Africa, but there is a lot of information coming out about women's activities. And I'm just using that as one example, and that there are journals appearing around the world published by women, published by feminists, which are reporting on items of great interest and which are not all the same.
Well, you realize, of course, that the media are reactors to things that go on, and they rarely institute news. If something happens, we cover it until it gets tedious.
I'm just saying it is happening,
but one
has to know where to look.
Yeah.
For evidence that it's happening.
Well, something tells me, being in this profession for 28 years, that we don't look too hard. In Blood, Bread, and Poetry, there's an essay that I was interested in, and this is the one in which you seem to be justifying lesbianism for political, social, and philosophic reasons, and you go into great detail about this. And I'm not challenging this, but I'd like to ask you some questions about it, because many of the homosexuals that I have met have told me they don't know why they're homosexual. It is just a fact. And yet you ascribe lesbianism, perhaps your own and others, to political reasons, that women have been unjustly treated and brutalized and this sort of thing, and thus lesbianism seems to be a justifiable response to that. Am I interpreting you correctly?
No, I have to take exception to that interpretation. I realize that is a correct interpretation of what some lesbian feminists have said. I mean, especially women who call themselves political lesbians. If you're talking about the essay called Compulsory Heterosexuality and Lesbian Existence, for example, I was trying to talk in that essay about the notion that heterosexuality is, quote, the normal route, and asking, if so, why has it had to be so enforced, and then trying to document ways in which it has been made compulsory in so many cultures, in so many ways. And I was identifying one way of rendering it compulsory as rendering lesbian existence invisible. That the lesbian choice, the lesbian possibility, the possibility that a woman might love a woman, and, you know, I would add that a man might love a man, sexually and emotionally, as much as a member of the opposite sex.
But many of the homosexuals I've talked to say that it's really not a choice. It's a compulsion.
I'm not talking about it as a choice, except, I mean, what do we mean when we say choice, we might well ask. If you don't know there is a choice, are you making a choice? Some people obviously are capable of recognizing that in themselves, which is, quote, against the grain, at a much younger age than others. I think that that's mysterious. I think that recognizing an identity that in some ways turns one's vision of the world upside down is mysterious at any age. But I wasn't trying to advocate lesbianism as a political choice. I was actually writing this essay for a scholarly journal, a feminist scholarly journal, in which I saw lesbianism being dealt with not at all. And I felt it was really important to say, why in a feminist scholarly journal can't you even talk about this? There's another thing which is political, which is that the examples of women who have chosen are lived independent lives and who have not been part of the kind of conventional world that we were talking about earlier is exemplary. It is exemplary, it seems to me. Not necessarily that every one of those women is herself an exemplary person, but that kind of ability to refuse to be defined, to refuse to be restricted, conventionalized.
So some of them seem... I was reading a review in the New York Times Sunday Book Review. What was the woman's name? Dworkin? Dworkin, the well-known feminist?
Andrea Dworkin.
Yeah. And I have not read the book, but I was just reading the review, and it was a novel, and it was coupled with a book, which I think it was called Intercourse, but I'm not sure if I have the title correct. But in it, she advocated non-intercourse as a violation of all women's rights. Now, again, I hadn't read the book, so I can't make a full judgment, but I did read the review, and the reviewer, who happened to be a woman, concluded that Dworkin was probably close to crazy. And I got that impression in reading the review, but isn't that going a little too far to, in effect, advocate to women that they should not engage in sexual relations because it's a violation of their rights? And
sexual
their
relations with men.
With men.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, Ms. Dworkin would not be in existence, of course. But doesn't that sound a little extreme?
Well, I have to tell you that given my own experience with my own books in the New York Times Book Review, I don't believe a review in the New York Times Book Review until I've read the book and checked it out. So, I haven't read Dworkin's books. So, I mean, I haven't read
them. She does have that rep, but I don't want to really talk about her as per se, but I only use that as an example to talk about extremism.
Well, I have to tell you that the extremism at this point seems to me where you are still getting women kicked out of jobs because they're lesbians, losing custody of their children because they're lesbians, losing their housing because they're lesbians, getting beaten up on the street because they're lesbians. I mean, that seems to me extremism. This is solely and purely about who you love and who you sleep with.
Men, too.
And men, too, of course. I mean, we were talking now about women, about lesbians. But yes, it all happens to men, too. And well, we have seen a period, we're still in it, of enormous, of the use of homophobia to scapegoat gay people generally as a political tool in the fundamentalist right. We have seen the AIDS hysteria used to scapegoat gay people. I mean, I feel as though there are the kinds of extremism that are dangerous to me. I mean, I'm not really afraid that the prescription that all women stop sleeping with men is going to upset any apple carts. I am concerned about the lives and the quality of the lives of gay men and lesbians whom I know and whom I know about, and how those lives are damaged and how they are threatened by present attitudes toward lesbians and towards gay men.
Well, that being said, was it a matter of courage or foolhardiness that led you to declare yourself as a lesbian? Weren't you, in effect, putting your reputation, your career, and to a degree, your physical safety on the line in doing that?
Well, I feel that my own strength and my own power draws very, very much on being all of who I am as much as possible at any given time. I mean, I can't split myself up anymore. I know about those splittings all too well. I mean, that split at the root, that split in the segregated city of Baltimore, those splits that we have been taught are natural between the male and the female, the masculine and the feminine in the self, between the aggressive and the passive, the creative and the receptive, all of those splits. I mean, I am tired of that. So it's very important to me to acknowledge who and what I am, and then to be able to use the language that goes with that as a writer, as a poet, not in code.
That being said, I think it's important, my feeling, to note that I don't consider you a lesbian poet. I consider you a poet because the poetry of yours that I've read, it cuts through emotions and intellect.
Well, I think you would find that true of most lesbian poets, if they're good poets. I mean, I certainly think of that as a quality in the poetry of Audre Lorde, of Irene Klepfisch, of Judy Gran.
Those are poets.
Very large numbers.
I don't know
of,
those poets, but those are poets I will have to look for. Are you still signing your letters in sisterhood?
Not indiscriminately.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time to talk to me, to answer some hard questions, and to shed a portion of your life and your background with me. And isn't it wonderful that we're able to talk about these subjects and know that this broadcast will be heard in 6 or 7 cities across the country? I'm not sure that 20 or 25, 30 years ago, we could probably go on the radio and talk about topics like this as frankly.
Now, that's important.
And I think to a great degree, the feminist movement has enabled us to be able to do that. Thank you.
Thank you.